The purpose of our meeting this morning is to clarify some of what we were questioning the last time we got together, frankly. We're still struggling to get our heads around some of the testing questions.
Right.
And so I'd like to go to Section 10, which is in on page R14, if you're following the side-by-side. And notice the commissioner has brought some folks with her. Basically, we have some questions for the department. So if Mr. Mattson and the commissioner could help us, this would be great. I really appreciate the time you're giving us. We're trying very hard to do due diligence, and we're still getting mixed up on how we understand some of these testing items and the implications for your workflow, to be honest with you.
Thank
so
you.
On page R14, lines 44-27, in that paragraph, we talk about the beginning of the new group that will take the grad test.
Mm-hmm.
And it would really help us, I think, if you explained, and some of this, I apologize, Commissioner, you explained to me privately yesterday, but it would, I think for the benefit of the group, it would help if you went over what is the timing for these children and its relationship to the grad test.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Ormel. Dirk Mattson for the department. I will try and do so without diagrams, and I have a feeling my hands will be going all over the place. What happened is, just a very brief history, as the BST was eliminated, then the graduation requirement, I believe it was in the last session, but I could be wrong, last or the year previous, put in place that the graduation requirement would be the MCA2. That is where we currently test, and we currently test in reading in 10th grade and 11th grade mathematics. It also, part of the language here, it also talked about the MCA2 in writing, which doesn't exist. So we tried to help clarify some of that language. So because the MCA2 is only given once a year, there is no retest opportunity for students. They would have, if I were in 11th grade, I'd have to wait till 12th grade again when it was given in the spring.
Right.
And that's not going to be frequent enough for students, definitely. So we did make the highest standard, kept the intent of the legislation that was there previously, the highest standard to be the MCA2. And that is a very, as you may know, a very rigorous test, 65 questions. And students, and there's the proficiency mark, or essentially the passing mark on that test, has already been established. It was established last year when the tests were brand new, and that's the additional technical work that took us a while to do. So currently, as was stated in the last year's legislation, students have to demonstrate proficiency on the MCA2. So out of those 65 questions, in lay terms, they have to get X number right, or they have to get so many points, what have you. Because there isn't a retest option for the MCA2s, the department recommended putting in place a supplemental test, if you will, or a retest that could be done on computer, that could be done relatively efficiently. It was in the design of the test, the intent was to try and keep that rigor of the test as close to it as possible, but knowing that we were not going to be able to match exactly in the retest. And there are a couple reasons for that. The main one is the constructed response no longer exists in the graduation test. So in the MCA2 test for reading or math, there are 25 questions that count both for MCA2 and for the graduation test. So when students sit down to take it, even though they're not aware of it, they're actually taking two tests at one time on the paper test. We've embedded these graduation questions. We're counting them for both tests. And then there are an additional 15 questions for the grad-only portion of the test. And again, students are not aware of which portion of what they're answering. Perhaps by content, if they're really astute and have studied the test specifications, they might be able to figure it out. But so we will then, the plan is to then score first, and timing of this is a little dependent. We have to look at our schedules. But we would score first for the MCA2. And that includes, that timing is a little bit delayed. In fact, I was having a conversation with staff just this morning about this. That timing is a little bit delayed because of we have to have humans score the constructed response. So in a perfect world, we would first get a score for the MCA2 and say, did you pass on that particular test? And then if not, we would look back to the grad test, which contains 25 of the same items, but 15 of what we're calling essential learning skills. And those skills are basically eighth grade type of benchmarks. They aren't. It's inaccurate to say they're eighth grade benchmarks, but they may look like that more. They're essentially, this is what they must have mastered to get out of high school. We'll look then to that 40 questions, only multiple choice, to determine if they passed at that point. If they did, we're all set to go. Now, just very quickly about the timing of it, we may, just so we can provide students information much more quickly, we may kind of reverse the order, although our ideal is to have them pass the MCA2 first and then have this retest that's embedded. Because it's multiple choice, we can get the answer for the retest for the grad quicker, faster. We can do that computer. I mean, as far as the scanning, we'll know how they answered. So assuming the student did not pass the MCA2, did not pass the embedded paper test for the grad, those 40 questions, then we would have a computerized test that's available on demand that's only 40 questions. And it would be essentially the same rigor or same level as that embedded paper test that was there at the beginning. And that test, we're saying on demand, so it would essentially, after I take the MCA2, let's say in at the end of April, if we do the grad portion first and say we'll score that first just to check, I could take the computerized version of it probably by early June. I'd have my score and I'd be ready to go. And then our idea at this point is to essentially, what's the right phrase? I want to use the phrase lock out, but at least put a hold on the student. They can't come back tomorrow because they didn't pass today. There's what we're trying to do is force remediation and give a report there and say, here's where you didn't do so well on. We're showing that the geometric concepts you did not do well on. Take the 6 weeks, go back and look at that. And after the computer would know, here's 6 weeks, I'm logging in again, it would allow the student to take the test. Doing this process of this kind of 6 to 8 week hold so they can have remediation, we've identified the ability to have the same number of retest opportunities that are currently there for the basic skills test in eighth grade, if you count those paper administrations every 3 months. What this essentially would do was eliminate a testing window for the school. Because the student, as I've explained this to administrators and teachers, is the student would, if I spent some time with Mr. Mattson after school for the past 3 weeks and my time is available now that I can get back on the computer, we'll come in after school and we'll take that test right there in my classroom. On the computer, we'll log you in. There doesn't have to be a shutting down of the school to administer this test or computer labs and so on, because it's done at an individual level for those students. So in a nutshell, that's our intent with that particular assessment.
Madam Chair, also I think your question was, when does the grad apply for which, what year? And it's for this year's ninth graders?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. Yes,
thank you. Getting back on task here.
Thank you. she does that often for me. The ninth grade, the BST writing test is given this year for the last time to 10th graders in order to equal the testing load a bit, and a little bit by the request of districts. Ninth graders have the writing test. It's the highest percentage passing on the first time, so we put that test earliest to kind of get it out of the way. Then, so ninth graders are required to pass the grad in writing under this legislation, which is essentially the same test as the BST.
As ninth graders.
That's correct. Yep, as ninth graders. So this year's ninth graders took this test. If this legislation does not continue, it does not move through, it is essentially the BST, so we just do a name change. But it is the grad test in ninth grade, and then those kids moving on to 10th grade next year, those will be the first students that are responsible for passing either the MCA2 or the grad retest.
And then 11th grade. Madam Chair, and one of the reasons that, just to kind of give some historical perspective on this, we used to administer the basic skills test in eighth grade. All students had to take that. And then they started to take the writing and the reading and the math. And one of the things that we were discovering is when they were taking those high school tests. They weren't taking them very seriously. And so we decided then at that point that one of the ways that the students would also take their MCA2s more seriously is if, and then also to kill two birds with one stone, so that we weren't having another administration, because then, remember, we also had to test the we had the MCA2s in eighth grade, too. So now you have the MCA and a BST, and, you know, just it, so there was practical considerations. Could we merge the two into one test so that there was one administration? So that was one of the things that we did. And then at the same time, by putting that grad requirement in your writing and in your reading and in your math, now the students, as Mr. Mattson said, they don't know which questions are part of the grad and which are part of the MCA2, so they've got to take those tests very seriously. So we're getting a good indication of how well our students are doing in writing, reading, and our math classes. So there was a couple of reasons for doing that, and then as Mr. Mattson said, then, if a student didn't pass those or answer a significant number of those questions, then they have the opportunity to retest. But now it's going to be computerized, which will be much more efficient. And as Mr. Mattson said, there is not going to be one testing window. We have a robust number of questions that we can, you know, change the test enough that it's, you know, not going to be figured out, if you will.
So let's see if I'm a good learner, and see if I can restate. We are shifting from a BST MCA1 model to an MCA2 grad test model.
Right, and with instead of them being separate, right. With the MCA1 being administered and a BST test being administered in separate times, now it's combined for efficiency's sake. And also for helping the kids, you know, take these tests much more seriously.
And so it has solved a couple of problems. Mm-hmm. It has become, as you just said, more efficient, and we've put some more motivation behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part of my question is, again, going back to or trying to say back to you, is the timing that's required is because you've, for all intents and purposes, put the BSTs aside. So this year's ninth, everything that's in here, this year's ninth graders, in effect, are impacted by this legislation.
Senator Armel, that's correct. And also, however, with that, the BST remains in place for those students who entered under that rule.
Right. So then, okay. I've got to believe then you're pretty far along in creating the grad test part or the MCA2 part. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how that happened? And
well, the MCA2 had the math test has been. This will be the second year of its administration. The grad portion, however, I'll let you explain that portion.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Armel, we have been planning for this since the inception of the MCA2s, and that is on every test. Because this test was designed from the outset to anticipate these 15 additional items, right now, of course, they don't count for students. But because we wanted to set the standard last year on the test that all kids would be taking from here until the test shifts again with new sets of standards, there were additional spots on the test, additional places to put questions that didn't count for students, but we could start building our item bank. So we are fully ready and ready to go, kind of waiting for this legislation to pass to start putting in place. We've already made plans for putting a computerized sample test out that students would see this coming school year. We've got those plans in place. We have a very robust item pool now because we've had these additional spots for last year and this year to prepare those test questions and years to come. And in fact, the design of this test will allow students, even though you could take it eight times, and as the commissioner mentioned, they won't be able to go back and see it, we've got a design that within a couple of years will allow for, we've calculated approximately 10,000 different types of tests, forms that will be generated by the computer. It will go and pick a portion of this and a portion of that. They may see a couple of the same questions if they're there for the ninth time, but the chances are very low. So we've done a lot of planning in the stages, and we are ready to go forward with this particular assessment.
And then I'm going to just restate what I've heard to make sure I'm clear. The MCA2s are given paper pencil, mm-hmm. and then the grad test retake is on a computer.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And it's, I'm just going to assume, maybe I shouldn't assume anything, every school has the computer capability to do that online?
We are, Senator Emma, we are very confident that that test, this particular one, we certainly are going through some growing pains with our online testing, but that particular test, because it is simply multiple choice, is a very low technology need. It's going to be a click the button. It's almost like if a web browser can work on a computer in a district, they'll be sitting, and that's probably even higher than they need. So we're very confident, and because this test is going to be taken, there isn't a window, it's just open all the time. There isn't this need to run 30 kids through a lab, move them out, put another 30 in. It's at their discretion. And so we're relatively confident both in the infrastructure and in the capacity of computers that districts will be able to do this. And in fact, they've been the ones suggesting that this go onto computer as well.
So how does this work? I'm a sophomore and I'm taking the reading test and I don't pass.
Senator Rummel, if the question is for this year, if the students right now who are taking the 10th grade reading test, there is no passing for those students. It's a system check, the MCA-2. So there is no stakes attached to at the student level for passing that test. In fact,
in subsequent years and the reading?
Starting next year, there will be a passing mark for graduation. But because that doesn't impact until those kids get there next year, that's been the issue that the commissioner mentioned, is there is no stakes
for those
kids.
So this year's ninth graders, when they're 10th graders,
the reading test will have
the embedded grad test.
Have the grad test.
Okay, so yeah. I find out that I don't pass either of those.
Mm-hmm.
So I can start taking that grad test over and over again?
Yes.
That's correct.
Okay. Then I'm an 11th grader. The next year I'm in 11th grade, and I have the same trouble. Darn it, I'm not good at math. So I don't make the cut on either one, but I have through my 12th grade to continue to attempt to pass the...
Yes.
Senator Rome, if I can just quickly...
I'm sorry I'm belaboring this, but I really have to try it on.
No.
Please, it's complex even when I have the pictures. We have estimated that students will have up to 8 times to retest by the time they get to their walk across the stage as 12th grader in graduation. That's for the math test and probably more for subsequent tests earlier on. We also have received advice from our National Technical Advisory Committee, that is a group of national testing experts that come to advise us quarterly on here's where we are, here are plans at psychometric and technical issues, that legally, defensively, they recommend 5 retests before graduation is more than sufficient, and we have 8 and beyond. They can continue. So we feel very comfortable both legally, appropriately, ethically, and so on, that we've identified the issue and have proposed a good resolution.
And how quickly, in terms of a turnaround knowledge for the student and their instructors, how quickly do we anticipate that to happen so we can have proper remediation, if you will?
Sure. Representative Mariani, if we're talking about the computerized portion, even the paper test and how quickly we can get that out, or definitely on the computer itself, we've been discussing that. I would say we can probably do it within about 48 hours. Mm. From a technology standpoint, there's no reason why we can't have it show up immediately. But from a legal and a quality control standpoint, because this is so high stakes for students, we want a human to go back and verify that that score is the right score, there was not a glitch, etc. So one thing we've been identifying is we may give right there on the screen, your preliminary score is you got 32 out of 40 correct or something like that. But then we will have an official letter be processed, or our thought right now is to the district test coordinator put a PDF on the website, secure website, that says here's their official report 48 hours later. Humans checked it, we verify this is the correct score. And in that report, if they didn't pass, we've already designed the student report to say you're deficient in this area or this area, you need to do some additional work there before you take the next test. So we've already got ideas for that report to come out in the process for that.
Now, does that is that solely on the retake part, or you've got the grad embedded in the first go at it? Do you anticipate the same kind of turnaround that first goal?
Are you talking about, I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, are you talking about the MCA 2 or the grad?
Well, my understanding is that the grad is embedded in the MCA 2.
Yes, so, okay.
So at that point, is there also a similar, I mean, obviously with the MCA 2, there's not going to be a quick turnaround like that.
Representative Mariani, it depends on, because that is, even though it's embedded, the first time they take it is paper, there certainly will be a delay because the school has to box those up, ship them back, and they have to get scanned. But once they're scanned, because they're only multiple choice, we anticipate that same kind of report could be produced relatively quickly. Let's say the window is out, ends on the typically in the first week in May. I would see no reason why there couldn't be a report by the third week of May or somewhere in there to let me know where I am and plan my first weeks of the summer accordingly. So it will be an additional time, most definitely, but still we could do that very quickly.
Now that brings another question to mind that I didn't anticipate. What scores go on the transcripts of the students? Does, if the student doesn't retake the 10th grade reading test, do they? They just take the grad portion?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So the score that goes on their transcript, is it their retake of the grad test or is it the MCA score?
Actually, Madam Chair, there is no requirement right now for the district to put any score on the test. I believe we do have...
On the transcript.
I'm trying to remember if it's the House or the... I believe it's the House version that does require the students... yes, it's on R17... Line 24, that we are proposing a statement in there that requires the school to put the score on the transcript, and that would be the MCA 2 score, because from a logistical standpoint, if the student has to retake the grad test several times, trying to keep track of, and they're taking it at various open times, is very challenging to do. So part of this is even a short-term solution to the motivational effect for students to say, this score will be recorded on your transcript.
And Senator, my understanding is that the department asked us for this language.
I'm just going to suggest I have a little bit of a problem with it because, and it may be because I don't understand this, I thought the MCAs were a way to test the system. And what is the value of sticking for life on a kid's transcript a score that was meant to measure the system and not the individual?
Senator, you are correct. The initial intent and the number one goal of that is to provide a system check on the district, etc. But there is no reason from a technical standpoint that score is not a valid score at the individual level by any means. That score does hold merit and weight at the individual level. In fact, it is not an uncommon practice for districts to list that within the student's cumulative file, et cetera. As for, one of the things we do with our testing contractor is produce labels for districts that request them that go on there along with all the rest of their educational assessment information.
And, Madam Chair, one of the rationales for it was also to incent the students to take this test seriously, that it is important. So that we were trying to think of different strategies for students so that they wouldn't just kind of blow off the test, if you will, in 11th grade when they're taking the math test. So this is another incentive. And then also you have language, I'm not sure if it's in the Senate or the House or both, that also are looking at, should we consider at least, well, they've, I think the language says reading, writing, and, the math as, looking at them as college ready, setting a cut score for college ready. Now, you and I have talked, and I think I've talked to the House, too, about that a ninth grade test is probably going to be kind of hard to, determine college ready. Then I think there's a bigger discussion about whether you want to have later tests that, you could really equate to college ready. But that we know that the 11th grade math test certainly would be a test that you could also think about. And we are doing that now with our next iteration of our math revision, making sure that the standards that are set for our, next iteration of math requirements does include college-ready kinds of preparation. So that, you know, is, again, those are all those, all these issues that we're talking about as far as grad requirements, how we're going to set our standards in the future, and whether we should be doing some of this stuff. So that was the rationale behind it. It was just one more kind of way to, you know, to make what these students are doing and what they're studying, because they are all related to our standards that we've developed, really, you know, take it seriously.
How do we know what score represents college ready? I thought we had our first discussion indicated that there was some discomfort with setting a college ready score.
Well, Madam Chair, and you're right. What I was saying is that we have been exploring with our math test, our MCA-2, in fact, all last year and the year before in the P16 roundtable, we were just looking at our MCA-2 math test, and we had psychometricians from the University of Minnesota, from MinSCU, and from the private colleges, plus our department, looking at our test and the standards behind our math MCA-2. And then once everybody looked at that and looked at the content within it that was being tested, and having them respond to, well, here's, you know, what our math courses look like at the university, you know, the first courses that you take in math, and at MinSCU and our college, our private colleges, and we think, you know, that this is a pretty rigorous test. It could be used as a placement test, if you will, you know, that would indicate that you were ready for college-level courses. We got to the point where, okay, everybody kind of agreed and we're comfortable with that. Do you want to set a cut score now that would say if you got this score, we would consider, and that was put on your transcript, we would consider you, you know, you wouldn't have to take another placement test when you got to our institution. The institutions are not ready to do that. They want to see two more years of test data of our students before they're ready to commit to having that as an indicator on the high school transcript. So that's kind of where we're at with this. We're trying to think of ways to even eliminate redundancy as far as, and also indicate that, you know, what kids are taking in school are acceptable. You know, we're trying to work with our higher ed institutions, too, to try to have this really robust system and indicators of achievement. So it's in process. And then when you get down to, if you have a ninth grade writing and a 10th grade reading, well, can you really start equating or putting college readiness kinds of benchmarks in a ninth grade test? Because really, they've got, you know, three or four more years of study. So that's where I think we can do it very comfortably with the math, because that's in 11th grade. But when you get into the lower grades, I think it would be a little bit more difficult to do that. Now, we are, the P16 partnership is looking at our language arts standards, and they have worked nationally, and this is, again, a consortium of all of the higher ed institutions, private and public, and our staff, and looking at our standards that will be revised in 2 years for language arts. And we're working with ADP, the American Diploma Project, and ACHIEVE, and they are consulting with lots of states on how you can look at those standards and make sure that there's college-ready content in those standards. And then, so we've kind of got that one in progress. And then we also want to start working on our science standards, because those will be also coming up for revision soon. So we are doing this work, and we're doing it through the P16 partnership. And it just it takes a long time, and it's a lot of hard work. But, you know, we are trying to, you know, take all of that into consideration as we move forward with our revision cycle.
I'm going to have to think about that a little bit, get my head around it.
Well, and that's certainly, those are very valid questions, but that's the rationale behind it. And so there are other ways maybe you could approach it also. But,
Madam Chair, can I just add, too, that I will say this actually, I can't say it's, we've taken a survey. This particular piece of language there on page 47 has been requested to me when I've gone out to districts several to present, et cetera. It actually has been impetus from secondary principals saying we need a little more help providing some motivation for that particular assessment. So I'd be interested.
But having their graduation already linked to the test, wouldn't that be sufficient until at least we have the data that over the long term indicate that whatever the cut score we choose is in fact predicting what we say it's predicting? And I just think it's a little premature right now. That's just where I'm at, and I need to think about it some more.
Well, Madam Chair, and that certainly, as we said, you know, we were trying to respond to district requests, and this has been an issue over time that has been something that we have discussed in the past. But certainly, you know, that's the rationale behind it.
Before we move on, were there any other questions about this part of the testing?
Just one, and that is, I just assume that you make accommodations for students of need, you know, special ed, those kinds of things. That's all built into this.
Yes, that definitely is. In fact, we have in the page we originally began on, we have identified how students with IEPs would be accommodated, how students that are English language learners would be accommodated. So we've 504 plans, etc. So we've done that as far as the graduation mark is concerned, and then certainly we are required by the standards of testing to provide appropriate accommodations for students to match their learning situation, their learning environment.
The second topic, and I really appreciate your patience and the time you're giving us on this, but at least I feel the burden of the decisions we make here for the many children in our schools, and I want to make sure that I understand what I'm signing on to. Would like to move over to page R18 and R19. These are kind of linked. This is, again, we brought this up the other day, and we're still trying to clarify our understanding of value added. And my first question has to do with we've had our MCA2s now for 2 years.
This will be the second year, Madam Chair.
So do we have, in fact, the data now that we need to begin to explore a growth model?
Madam Chair, yes. At the individual student level, we're very comfortable with that. We've identified, and we will be reporting for parents on the individual student report, a growth score from last year to this year for those students that we can match, obviously, that we can do the data on. There are some additional technical considerations that need to be made when you go forward for school and district as far as did this school grow or did this district grow. And we want to make sure that process is fair and appropriate and takes into consideration all of those psychometric and technical reasons to and to not do it, et cetera. So we are looking to expand how that's the muscle that score has for other purposes, but we want to do it in a very measured and appropriate way.
And Madam Chair, too, we also want to make sure that there's understanding that we have value-added language in current law.
Yes.
So people, I think, get confused with value-added and growth, and we interchange them.
Anticipating my question.
Okay. And I'm probably not the best person to explain it, except that growth is a more simple statistical way of looking at how well a student is doing. But when you start looking at the site or the district, and you want to look at the value that has been added to that particular educational progress, then that becomes a little bit more of a complex process. But we are instructed to do that, and so we are. We've got our test set up for alignment, and I better not say any more because I will be not saying the correct terminology. But we are preparing for this value-added, you know, growth type of process for our schools, and it would be done at the school and district level. It would not, and certainly you would have the individual student data, but that is all the further that we intend to go with this model.
Well, that's precisely my question. How is the department framing or describing your work toward this value-added model? How do you describe it? What does it look like? What are its components?
Senator Rummel, that's a very good question, and it's ones that those are questions that to which we do not yet have the answers, because for the most part, those are essentially policy questions, and we need to first of all frame out how we'll make those policy decisions, bringing in the right stakeholders and so forth. There is in value added, and the commissioner did a fine job of explaining it. It is identifying to what added value to the student's education. That is the intent of that. Growth is just saying the kid got better. Value added is saying who or what was responsible for that getting better. And in those value added models, there is a family of value added ways you can do it. There are probably five, I don't know, I'm not going to be able to run my family analogy here, but there are about five different major methodologies that are used in the literature right now. Some, as the commissioner has said, are very simple, and some are very complex. But of course, and as many psychometricians as you can get in the room will defend each one that theirs is the best. And so one of the challenges we have to do is balance the policy decisions of, let's say, this complex one that includes socioeconomic status and gender and race. And I mean, they can put all kinds of variables into that mix and make it come out, as can the folks who propose the more simple models that are almost like a half step beyond growth. I can say ours is better. So it's a balance between which variables does Minnesota value? That's the first question. Which ones do we want to hold schools and districts accountable for, or feel that those are influencing factors? Find the right model for that, and then start to put together a technical process or psychometric process and all that other fun stuff that then puts it into a place where it's transparent enough that people understand it. I can guarantee you the one that's the most complex will be the most challenging to explain to parents and teachers. And yet, at the same time, the psychometricians who support it will say it might be the most complex, but it's the most fair. It's the fairest. So there is that conversation we expect to begin later on this summer. We're having initial conversations internally on how to frame up the stakeholder input and how do we structure those conversations so we have the right answers and we go down a right road. It isn't by any means, and I just had this conversation with my boss the other day, which was it's not three or four of the psychometricians in the research department saying, well, we think, yeah, we should include socioeconomic status. It can't be done that way, and we know that. And it will take us a year or at least 6 months to have those conversations, understand the process. Putting the formulas together, quite frankly, is the easy part. It's the policy conversation about what do you want to attribute value to that we need to discuss first.
And Madam Chair, also I want to let you know that we have a No Child Left Behind stakeholders group that's been in effect since actually No Child Left Behind was established, certainly before I've been commissioner. In fact, I served on it as a legislator, and we have legislators. Representative Greiling is on it, and I'm trying to think who from the Senate side is on it. So we have and then we also would invite any representative or senator that any time would want to come to the stakeholder meetings. And in fact, we'll make a very sincere effort to invite every, to let you know when our stakeholder meetings are. But we also had, and I think you attended, the value-added symposium that we had, and we brought in people from all over the country that have instituted some form of a value-added model. And we wanted to listen to their pros and cons, their cautions, as they develop their system. And so then we will start having again now meetings with these stakeholders to say, all right, where do you want us to go as the state of Minnesota? They are advisory to the commissioner, and we have a very robust group of folks that represent schools and the superintendents and the school boards and the teachers, and it's a wonderful group, and we really have wonderful, robust discussion, and would invite any of you. It's an open meeting, so anyone can come anytime to participate in it. But it has been invaluable. I felt it was invaluable when I was a legislator to just get an understanding of No Child Left Behind and the complexity, and so it was really helpful then. And when I became commissioner, I insisted that continue because I thought it was very valuable to have everyone at the table that had a stake in this to really hash this out and talk about it. And it's a no-holds-barred kind of a stakeholders group, and I love it because we do get really good, strong discussion. And we tend to, after everything's over, and when I say we, I mean I really look at this as a partnership. This isn't something that I regard as, you know, there's some advisory boards that you know, you feel like after you've served on, it's like, well, why did I spend, you know, my time doing this? But this, I feel like, has been just a very meaningful one because we really take all of this to heart and really do follow up and accept much of 90% of the advice that is given to us. Sometimes the advice we don't take is really because maybe our national TAC has said, you know, that's not going to work legally for you, and we don't know that at the time, you know. So you have, you know, sometimes what we make decisions on, then we find out, you know, is not a valid or reliable or a legal kind of a process. But that would be really the exception. So that is the process that we intend to continue and, you know, work on as we try to frame what we want our system to look like.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the work of this stakeholders group. I'm learning more and more about them. Can you, and this is coming from at least the way I approach projects, I usually typically kind of frame out, I've got until X date to do Y. I have to have this done by here. And do you have some key steps or what would you call milestones kind of lined up for yourself? Because the reason I'm asking, we've got down there on line 49, I guess, a change of date, 2008 and 2009. Can you kind of block out how you're planning to go about getting that? Is that a reasonable thing?
Sounds like a voting.
We hope, Madam Chair, we hope that that's a reasonable thing. One of the things that will be kind of the, it depends on what we want to do, because we also have been trying to attempt to get approval from the federal government to use our value-added model as part of our safe harbor. They're not allowing states to use it as a substitute for the status or the, you know, system test at this point. But so we are looking at that. And really one of the questions that the stakeholders group has said is, well, you know, do we want to keep pursuing that? And I think that we finally decided, yeah, we want to do that. But at the same time, we want to just design our system. You know, we want to do it regardless. So we're trying to balance those two things and do both at the same time. So part of it will be, we'll go ahead, you know, we'll submit whatever it is that we decide to do to the feds. If they don't approve it, that's fine. We'll still go ahead and implement our value-added system. But it is a
809. I'm still looking, though, for how we get from here to there.
Yeah, so okay. How long is it going to take, Mr. Mattson?
Senator Hubble, we believe that date is that it has been proposed here, the 08-09 date, is adequate. The reason why the 06-07 was simply we weren't going to make it is, again, because those policy conversations had not yet happened to the richness that they had to happen.
And then at the same time, excuse me, Madam Chair, also at the same time, the feds finally came out with their directions as to what they would accept for value added. And at a minimum, they said we had to have 2 years of testing data. Well, we had just started our new test, and we only had 1 year. And so we said, well, you know, there's no sense in us spending, you know, huge amounts of time working on this until we have 2 years of data. And we've been working on it. We've been, you know, trying to put the things in place. But, you know, so that's why we didn't pursue the – that's why the 06-07 went by.
I'm not worried about that. I'm just still looking for those milestones.
Okay, give us those
what
milestones.
What has to happen by September? What has to happen by December?
Yeah, Senator Rummel, in the year count, I think by this fall, we will begin having – we want to make sure those stakeholder conversations are focused and have kind of some objectives at the end of their time frame. I will tell you that we've been looking a bit to Ohio as far as how they've mapped it out and gone around the state, essentially, and had similar stakeholder committees. By September, we will have – we hope to have the structure in place for how we will have those policy conversations, when major decisions will be made about what are we going to attribute value to. I would suggest that it probably will take the better part of the next school year to have that well-vetted. I just think of the academic standards process that usually takes about a year to go through a revision. Here's our next try. What do you think of that? And it comes back again. So I would anticipate it's going to take us about a year to really have solid and thorough vetting of the policy implications for value added during the next school year. So that will bring us to the year of 08, the spring of 08. And then we should be ready to go. It, again, you know, if I had my psychometrician sitting next to me, they'd kick me under the table. The technical part of it is not as hard once we've determined what we're going to put in the formula and what we're going to keep out.
So who decides that?
That is, again, Senator, the decisions of the stakeholder groups, of the commissioner's advisory group, of this body, and so forth.
But who builds the test?
We will use the data from the MCA2 currently to determine the value added. So it's based on the performance on that test and then looking
but
at
is that you or is that someone else?
Well, Madam Chair, what Mr. Mattson is saying is that we have to decide what our value-added system is going to look like. So let me give you an example. We may decide that as part of our value-added process, we want to make sure that if a student is 2 years behind in reading, that they have to make at least a year and a third worth of growth so that they will be on track if they're in third grade by fifth grade of, you know, being, you know, clearly ready and test, you know, can be achieving things at the fifth grade level. So that may be one of the decision points that we make. So then if that's agreed to by the stakeholders group, then that direction goes back to then the psychometricians, and then that will guide their how they build the test. That's a pretty simple illustration, but those are some of the kind of things that you have to do. If the stakeholders group says, "All right, we want to take into account poverty," if we want to take into account, you know, you name the thing, well, then there has to be some kind of maybe weighting infrastructure that's built into the test that would allow for that or to adjust. And I may be using wrong terms.
Well,
now he's getting nervous. But shut up.
Madam Chair, let me just very quickly try and clarify. The commissioner's right. Again, I just want to be clear. The test is not changing. It's the students.
Right.
The score of the test, if we do take into account, and that is a policy decision of poverty or geographic region or you name the variable, then we have to be able to determine it was student X, and student X has these characteristics.
Well, I understand that.
Right.
I'm not lost in that. I'm trying to figure out who does this.
Yeah.
Do you need an RFP? Who is the person that puts
Madam Chair,
together?
No, you don't need an RFP. I mean, we've got psychometricians in our department that are responsible for doing all of this work. So that, you know, it's just like when we build a new test, they will you know, be part of the process. They'll work certainly with the test vendor that is hired. But you know, they will set up the process for doing this, and it will be, you know, simply, you know, a response to whatever the framework is that we want to set up for what our value-added model looks like.
And I hope, Senator O, hopefully this will clarify, too, as far as who's the who that's doing it. We do, as we currently do with we have built it into our testing contracts when this is up and running, that it will be a part of, there will be, just as we do a three-way check on the results of our tests right now, the department verifies the results through analysis, our test vendor verifies the results through analysis, and we have a third-party quality control vendor that verifies the results through analysis. And we all must match exactly to the fifth decimal place. Or we start over. We go over again and we say, where did we lose it? We were matched until this point. That same process is already in our contracts for the value-added verification process. So the people that do it are everybody that currently does the testing process.
I'm looking at line 49-8, and is it 49-8? Yes. And we've got the word growth crossed out. I don't know who crossed that out. And value added is there. Would it make more sense, at least from the people I'm hearing from, that we rewrite that phrase, a growth component rather than a value added component?
Madam Chair, I think that we've traditionally, I mean, historically, have always had the value added terminology in our law. And so that's why we have, you know, consistently...
But I understand that the federal government is really looking at growth models and not value-added models. And so why are we pushing down one avenue when both our public and the federal government are looking at a different one?
Oh, sure.
Senator Rummel, they're not. They're you're correct, and by striking the word growth from that sentence, it was not. They're not mutually exclusive. We're going down both paths at the same time. The intent of the department's suggestion to strike the word growth was only to try and help, to whatever degree possible, clarify the difference between growth and value added. That it's not a synonymous term, but we certainly are. We have every intent of working toward a growth component for our No Child Left Behind elements and so on. And as I said at the symposium at which you were at, we know also, though, too, there are very many restrictions on that growth, and it's not a magic bullet as far as getting schools showing improvement according to the federal requirements. So the intent was only to try and help clarify the difference between growth and value-added, and then value-added is not growth. But we already have and will report this spring the student-level growth, and then are looking at appropriate ways to do it at the school and district.
I'm going to offer the mic to other people if you have questions. I didn't mean to dominate this.
No, excellent questions.
Even that, maybe that whole day at the MDE was enough to confuse me so that I had to unravel it again. And I appreciate the patience of both the commissioner and Mr. Mattson.
It sounds to me, Commissioner, like the stakeholders group is a critical group, and you're looking for perhaps an even more dynamic, proactive work from this group in the coming months here. And that's good. I think we want that as well. I think this focus on Dr. Mattson, you talked earlier about some of the components, and I've heard this before too. That transparency to the public is just key here, regardless of what model we come out with. If the public doesn't understand it and doesn't own it, this legislature is going to have a hard time understanding it and owning it as well. Now, is there anything about this discussion that begs any kind of further, from your perspective, any further legislative clarification around on policy as you get deeper into these, you know, Minnesota value-based factors that hopefully will be coming from your stakeholders, from the stakeholders group? Does any of that beg any further legislative? Do you have enough in your opinion, is there enough clear language here for you to continue to move unfettered here?
I'm going to give Ohio an example. Okay. Representative Mariani, thank you. I guess I would say I believe the language that's here is sufficient, not to say that, I wanted to speak to your transparency comment, too,
no,
which
go ahead,
is,
please.
It is very challenging, and certainly to even explain what a scale score is to a parent, which is a transformation of the raw score, and now I've used a three-syllable word there too. You know, I mean, it becomes very, and I've always said there is, as I tell people, there's a continuum in testing. It's either, there is somewhere in the middle between fair and very complex, or probably not so complex, but probably not so fair. There, it's in somewhere that becomes the balance. So I would say that this legislation does the job. I would also just add very quickly, talking with Mitchell Chester, who did also present at our symposium, spoke to the fact that the Ohio legislature, and he's the assistant superintendent there, actually wrote in more specifics that, on hindsight, he was a little reluctant that they had, because it reduced the flexibility of trying to pick the best model. It almost kind of tied their hands a little bit more. I think if the process is open and fair, and the end product is open and fair and all stakeholders are a part of it, I think this will allow for that to happen.
And Madam Chair and Representative Mariani too, I'm just going to put my parent hat on for a minute and just think about, you know, when my kids were going through school, the tests that we always received were, I think they used the Stanford and maybe the Iowa Basics when I was back in Missouri. And all we got was, if our kid was at the 95th percentile of the national average or whatever. And I never asked, what was the psychometrics behind how, you know, these different levels of percentages got there. All I wanted to know is what was the national average and was my kid above or below and how far. And I think sometimes we get, I mean, I think definitely as policymakers and as all of the stakeholders in the state, you know, as we're developing a system, we want to make sure that we are developing a really robust, fair, as Mr. Mattson said, something that is not too simple that it's unfair, but not too complex that, you know, it's nobody quite understands it who really cares about it that would be the psychometricians. But at the end of the day, we can say with confidence that what we have is a very good, strong, fair indication of how our students are doing year by year, each one of our individual students, and then how our system is doing if we're checking that out. So I think that's the discussion that we have to have with the stakeholders is what we want to see, what would be the components of it, and then we move forward and then we hand it off to the folks that, you know, put together the actual calculations. But then at the end of the day, I think the way I look at it is you talk to the parents about, we've now created a system where you can track your child's progress from year to year. And if they're a typical student, you can be assured that if they get this, you know, score, that they have grown a year. If they've come in at typically at third grade and they've been there, the whole year, they're going to be ready for fourth grade. If they're behind, we're going to, you know, be able to tell you that if they've gotten to this point this year, they're on progress to be okay by the time they get to fourth or fifth grade, where they're moving along. Or if they're a gifted child, the same thing. Or if they're a typical kid and they've gone a year and a half, this is your child is really making some wonderful progress. I think that's, you know, what parents are interested in. I don't think parents are interested necessarily in, what were the scientific calculations for all of this? I think that's easy to explain, and I think the public has gotten that. Everywhere we go, people are talking about, we want a value-added, we want a growth model, we think that's a fair system. They understand that. That is understandable. I always feel like, well, I think the testing and, you know, psychometric people kind of, you know, get into all of this. What we need to be assured of as policymakers is that we have decided on what we want it to look like, what are the key components of it, and then, you know, have, you know, the geek people do what they need to do and have it tested many different ways, you know, with your national advisory groups and your experts and make sure that it's all been vetted very thoroughly. And then we have, you know, the confidence we can go out in the public and just talk about the more simple, here's where your kid is. So that's kind of where I, when I look at it, I think that's what we have to be assured of.
And now I'm going to put my school board hat on.
Okay.
And there are very, when we do value added, if we are going to go down a path where we attribute growth to the performance of a school, you know, and this starts us moving towards that complexity because the stakes are terribly high. And so because we have really one test with two parts or two things that have such large ramifications, I guess my concern is that we get it right and that we do it fairly. So I agree with everything you've said, but I just want to put in a plug that we have attached huge, huge consequences both to graduation and to, you know, if we're saying this school is doing great and this school is not doing great, the implications that has across the community is enormous. So,
well, Madam Chair, I just want to remind you, though, that this model will not, for all intents and purposes, will provide some safe harbor calculation. And it will really have more individual student data that will be informational for the parent that would be of interest. I don't think it's going to have as much of an impact upon, you know, whether somebody, a district, you know, is in or out of AYP. I think that it's not going to have that you know, huge of a of an impact as far as
that's what we said about the five stars.
Well, I we're not going to be using this to I guess what we have looked at is when the states that have this process now in place, I think Florida and
Tennessee,
they have literally seen just maybe three or four or five school districts that, because of the value-added calculation, have been in or out of ABLE. It hasn't made that much difference. I think the more value of it is being able to track individual student growth and having that information so that we can, to parents, and then just for the district to be able to look at it. I also have, and I'll pass it on to you, and I'll try to make copies. I just had received a study by the Carnegie Institute, and it's a value-added paper, and it really talks about just looking at, if you're going to do a value-added, just looking at your district and your school site, that is really where it should be used, and not really getting into any other linkages. And it's a very balanced paper, and I'll be glad to share that with you. I try to read as much as I can about it. So,
wouldn't it be nice if the media used it that way, though? And that I actually had people come and tell me that, depending on whether they were a 5-star or 4-star or 3-star school, the realty values changed. I mean, I would never in my wildest dreams have thought of that when we started down that path, that in fact we would be affecting the value of somebody's home. But so that's the only reason I'm being so cautious
and asking such deep questions. As I said, I don't think that even if we implement this, it's going to have that much impact on the change in your AYP status. It may or it may not. I don't know in Minnesota how it's gonna work. But I think the more important thing is to really start showing that when we know we have good schools that are doing great things, especially in our urban schools, we know we've got some schools that are just making tremendous gains with their children. They should be getting credit for that, and that should be very clear. So in Minnesota, we may have some completely different impact as we develop this. We're excited about it, and certainly we want to be sensitive to indicting, if you will, districts, and I'm as sensitive to that as
I know you are. I'm just making the point for the record.
Right. I mean, that's for sure part of the angst, and you've been here on this side of the. Mm-hmm. That's part of the angst with the legislature, is to the degree that this needs to all fit 100% inside the AYP designation, NCLB requirements. You know, we're getting a lot of pushback from constituents who are saying, we're questioning that framework, one. And two, give us information over and above and beyond what NCLB wants you to give us, because we really want to know beyond that how our schools are doing. We want to have a feel for what's going on there. We want to have a feel for how our students are doing over and beyond NCLB. And so, I think that's why you're getting partly why you're getting a lot of questions in this regard. I think we're wanting to stretch here as a state and not just have it totally dictated, by NCLB requirements. And so, I mean, certainly share your values and views on how far you think Minnesota can push and stretch beyond that.
And Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, we agree. We want to, as I said, we want to assure you that we want to create a really good, robust, value-added type of system so that we can really add to the information that parents have now and that schools have so that they can really continue to build on what they're doing, which is good stuff. So.
And Mr. Mattson, just to clarify, as I understood it, the 07-08 school year will be the year where you put those, let's call them specifications together, the policy ideas, and then 08-09, the year you construct.
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be correct. Your timeline is correct. And I think, too, as I was listening to the Commissioner speak, I think, too, that we talked about input and stakeholder, and I am... I am probably, I don't know if it's by design or by job responsibility, one of the most hesitant people in the whole department. I go very slowly. My feet are in cement as far as making sure it's right, and at times get prodded as well. And I think we've learned lessons in both regards about what's worked well in stakeholder and decision policymaking in Minnesota and what hasn't worked so well. For example, you know, I know the report card has been a topic of much discussion, and while I was not at the department during the implementation of that, I know that there were ed orgs involved and school districts involved, but all my hunch is, because I was in the district at the time, that didn't get probably as thorough a vetting, and probably there were some unintended consequences of that, as we've all heard about. And yet at the same time, lessons well learned are, I look at the process that the mathematics standards have gone through this current year, and while it's been, I know those folks have worked 36 hours a day to get them ready, they've gone through four drafts, they've been out on the web, they've gone for expert review, and they're, it's my understanding they're close to being ready, or if not, have already been presented to the legislature. And all the words I'm hearing from the expert reviews and also from the field is, These are the standards we like from Minnesota. These make sense. And so, to me, that says there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And I definitely want to do it the right way in this process. It's a very sensitive process, as the commissioner says.
No, go ahead, Adam.
No, I was just going to thank them. So.
Oh, no. I wanted to broach something. You know, this is a policy working group, but, you know, there are fiscal issues related to the department's requests for testing. And so I just wanted to, you know, broach that real quickly. We don't have to belabor it. But can you make a connection for us in terms of this whole conversation we just had in terms of the requests that the department has made for testing appropriations?
Yes, I would be glad to. And Mr. Mattson can actually fill in probably the detail. We have a separate request for the value-added implementation. I think it's $1 million-something. $1.4 million, $1.5 million. And then we also have requested an increase in our overall testing budget. I think the Senate has kept us at the base, and the House has increased our funding, but not as much as we wanted. I think we're about, well, we also had included in that $5 million to implement a formative test, go out for an RFP. But if you take that, if you, you know, just set that aside, we're still about $4 million short of what our actual request was to increase our testing budget. And Mr. Mattson, you can probably talk about some of the needs that we have over and above the value added.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, the other additional, the dollars in there, that the neat-looking graduation test that we talked about earlier is roughly, because it's on all the time, it's roughly about $2 million a year to run. It's a spendy test because we have to continually develop items. We've got students taking it all the time. You know, I've compared it to folks saying, if we only open the Department of Motor Vehicles for driver's license three times a year, as our current testing system does, it'd be pretty cheap. It'd be a long line, but it'd be pretty cheap. The problem is that I can go down there anytime I want, as far as 6 days a week. So to create a test like that and to provide, have the options for that, that costs us, we're estimating, approximately $2 million a year to run. We have, as the commissioner mentioned, a request for formative assessment dollars to be able to do that. We know districts right now, we see districts kind of with essentially the haves and the have-nots. Those districts that can afford to have a formative assessment aligned to state standards have it and love it, and those districts that do not wish for it and are sorry they don't. We also, the bulk of that money then, is designed for, some of it is also just for the testing costs money and the employees cost money and so on, in the sense that I know, just talking with my colleagues around the nation, we are at Florida, for example, spends 2.5 times the amount of money we do on testing, and they have a very robust system, but they're able to do that. The majority of the dollars we have requested are for additional either teacher or parent enhancements to our assessment system. So teachers and parents can get the information more quickly in a more user-friendly fashion. Right now, we're still a little bit in the 20th century, so to speak, as far as how we get results back to teachers. That we have designs for, or at least looked at, teacher-level information, secure information on the teacher's computer when they get back to the classroom this fall, both in the previous statewide assessments, and also we even designed, if the formative were to be in place, the formative data as well. And we know that that's not the only way that teachers are making decisions, but that, again, is kind of a response to when we're out talking to districts is, you showed me, first of all, help me get the data into a place where I can understand it and what it means. And then number two, now I've got the data, but I've already tried these three teaching strategies for increasing vocabulary. What else can I do? And we have some additional enhancements that will provide kind of a toolkit of other research-based instructional strategies and so on. So there, all of the things that we have lined up, are all of the monies there are for additional enhancements for teacher and student. Aside from the additional dollars to do this graduation test, all of those additional dollars are for enhanced reporting features that we think we could do.
Mr. Metzen, when will the RFP close for the next year's testing contract?
Madam Chair, the RFP typically is a one-year it's a one-year contract with up to four-year renewals. So right now we are kind of on the cusp of, we are ending one contract and we are current, so that's going to take us through the end of this testing cycle, which includes reporting. So we'll have one contract with us through the end of this summer, and we have begun the process of, actually we've had an RFP out and we've begun the conversations of negotiating the next one that will bring us for at least this, so we're in the process right now up to 5 years.
Let me ask a sensitive question here, and this is backing up to the more policy area where we, and you did a good job of laying out how you expect to, you know, proceed with the determination of a value-added model. We understand that some value-added models, you've got one of the values, one of the factors are teacher quality issues. Now, obviously, nothing's been determined yet because the process hasn't begun. But can you give us a sense of where the department might be in terms of its desire for pushing that kind of a factor into a value-added model?
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, actually in current law, there is specific language that says that this any kind of a value-added or growth system will not be connected with teacher impact. And there is just not, and the Carnegie, you know, the study that I just alluded to, really, you know, talks and balances that out, that there's just too much, too many variables, if you will, to start drilling down. Now, this Tennessee model has done that, you know, but they have. The one thing about the Tennessee model is that they literally have years of data because when they started their program, Tennessee, years before No Child Left Behind, it was probably 8 to 10 years maybe that they had a statewide test and they had been tracking student progress for years and years and years with student ID system. So they, you know, have had years, and that's the only way that you could actually do any kind of a value added if you had just absolutely years and years. And they say at least 5 years of data with a test and the whole thing. And people are saying because the value added or growth, you know, kind of concept is really relatively new in testing, that I think most people are saying be very cautious, be very careful on that. So it would be our intent that we would just be looking at district and site, and actually the legislature, we have current law that says that it's not to be linked to teacher. Now, that doesn't mean that for diagnostic purposes, you know, the districts will want to get that information so that if they're looking at kids' test scores in math, let's say, and they're discovering that, you know, maybe in their fourth or fifth grade they're really doing terrible, that they can't, you know, have that classroom data and that, you know, that teacher data that you would need, or classroom data for curriculum purposes and for improvement. You would want that data, and so that would all be there, you know, to drill down into your site and to really see what's happening with your math, let's say if it's high school even, and, you know, what's happening in your high school classrooms, you know, is it curriculum, you know, is it whatever. So the intent is not to do that. So that really probably will be our baseline even as we go into our working or our task force, our stakeholders group would be, you know, this is what current law is, so we have to first of all abide by current law. And then, you know, we start discussing from there what, you know, kinds of things we would want in it.
Thank you. Appreciate the clarity on that.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to get my head back up a little, get my head around the idea of the MCAs and the value added. Are the MCAs going to be a separate? I mean, is there going to be two reporting systems, one on the MCAs and one on the value added for parents, or for schools or for districts? Are you using the same test? Are there two different tests? I'm still trying to get my head around this. I know districts have kind of their own value added yet, many of them. They have their own tests that they're giving. Yeah. And would this replace that kind of test in a district that districts are currently using?
Madam Chair, Representative, the tests the districts are using are many of them are using a growth model test, but not necessarily a value added. There's only one district in the state that I know is using a value added because it's so complex to create. You need some very skilled people, and that's Minneapolis. Right. The MCAs would be the test. However, there would be, as we've talked about, multiple measures for assessing schools. There would most likely be, and it's not my decision to make in the end, but there would most likely be additional factors that would be there. Here is your status, and I'll just give you a for instance. Here's your status score on the MCA 2. Here's a growth score on how the school did on the MCA 2. Here is value added related to these other things. So it's a separate indicator, but it's not an additional, this isn't your value added test and here's your MCA 2 test. It's another way of, another slice through the prism of looking at the data.
Okay, that answers my question. Well, and I would hope that with the stakeholders that you meet with, that you will be able to, develop some sort of test so they won't have to have the current test, so we can eliminate one of those tests that we're currently having in districts.
Well, Madam Chair,
like the growth model test.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, the MCA is the only test that districts are directed to take. So it's because of No Child Left Behind. So that's why we don't want to create another test that they would have to take. So that's why we're using the MCA too. And instead of just a check in time, and different cohorts of kids from year to year, we will now be able to say, all right, this year's third graders have made this much growth from third to fourth grade. Here's the the value that's been added, et cetera, whatever. So that's how that would be handled. And then that is why we're saying then to the public to look at a more robust way of telling the public, here's what's really happening. It's not just a point in time, but yes, they've actually moved, this subgroup of kids along this much, much more than what they've been given credit for necessarily with the status system.
And Madam Chair, Representative, if I could quickly add to that, too, I don't know if I would really encourage the district to eliminate their local formative assessment. The MCA2s act as the state's final exam for the year. But yet that's their purpose. And yet there is a lot of, because we will get a growth score, we'll know how much they grew from year to year, but the teachers are definitely going to need more information along the way during instruction to be able to make those decisions. And that's the test that they're using. In many cases, the MAP test you've heard about and so on, that's what they're using is, here's a check right now on how to adjust my instruction tomorrow or the next week. As I've told folks, too, that MAP administration is only good for a couple of weeks because hopefully you've made a change in your instruction that the score will be different in 2 weeks when they take it. So, assessment, people say we're doing too much assessment and not enough teaching, and I always say, boy, that's part of teaching is assessing, and I don't mean in a formal way, but assessing, did my instruction today make any difference? And there's informal ways to do that, and there's more complex and more formal ways. So I think all of those serve different purposes. I wouldn't recommend to a district by any means. Also, if I know that Johnny's doing well, we have to do four checks on him just for me to feel absolutely confident and have all those tests. Those can be used at different levels with different students because the districts have that flexibility to do it.
And Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, that's why we also did propose that we have some money for a formative test so that all districts, if they wanted to do this, could. We would just do an RFP and have people submit to create a formative type of test that would be aligned to our standards so that we could have that in addition to, our request for the testing that we need to do for our No Child Left Behind process. So,
well, again, I appreciate your patience, and I was thinking this could be about 15 to 20 minutes. We've been here an hour and a half. But I think you've really helped us get deeper into this, and I really appreciate the time you've given us and the time the other committee members have given us. And those of you who have spent your morning with us, thank you for coming. And we will go back to work.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.